Welcome, everyone, to the 13th live session of our Neuroscience Training Summit. My name is Christy Peoples. I'm a producer here at Sounds True, and I'll be your host. Today, Lot Kelly will be teaching on how to train your brain to live an awakened life. He's broadcasting live from New York City while the Sounds True team and I are here in our Boulder studios. A free recording of this session will remain accessible for 24 hours. And if you wish, you can also purchase the entire series with unlimited access to each recording, to transcripts from each session, and bonus gifts from our presenters. And now, it's my honor to introduce you to Lot Kelly. Lot Kelly, who holds a Master's of Divinity and is a licensed psychotherapist, is also the author of Shift into Freedom, The Science and Practice of Open-Hearted Awareness, which was published here with Sounds True and was named one of the top 10 best books of the year by Spirituality and Health magazine. Lot is an educator and a recognized leader in the field of meditation. He's also a graduate of Columbia University and Union Theological Seminary, where he studied insight meditation, Advaita, and particularly Tibetan Buddhism in Sri Lanka, India, and Nepal. Lot is the founder of the nonprofit Open Hearted Awareness Institute, and he collaborates with neuroscientists at Yale, UPenn, and NYU to study how awareness training can enhance compassion and well-being. Welcome, Lot.
Thank you, Christy. Wonderful to be here and great to be with all of you and explore this exciting topic. I've had the opportunity to hear a few of the other presentations, and it's really just amazing quality of neuroscientists and a really exciting time to be alive and interested in this coming together of new sciences like neuroscience and psychology, science of the study of education, and particularly the coming together of the contemplative traditions, the wisdom traditions, and meditation with science. So there's been amazing growth. 100 years ago, scientists and spiritual traditions were at odds with each other and almost in competition. And recently, there's been a coming together. So there's even a field now called contemplative science. And that's really exciting. So a lot of the more traditional spiritual, religious, and meditative communities are open to have their practices studied by scientists, and the scientists are really open to discover the benefits and research contemplative practices. There's been an amazing amount of research, particularly lately, on meditation and mindfulness-based meditation practices, particularly because of the amazing early results of the benefits. And many of you know that is true, and the science continues to grow, and more research is done each day and each month and each year. The benefits, as you know, from just the basic practices are stress relief, reduction of anxiety, depression, reduction of blood pressure, physical changes, psychological changes, growing of brain matter, which moves from a state experience to a real trait experience. And I'm excited to be part of this. I'm not a neuroscientist, but I have been a psychiatric social worker. I've been involved in treating people with trauma, with different psychological, emotional, mental health issues, and seen tremendous benefits from the beginning of my training, which started actually with meditative training and then went to psychological training. So then recently I got involved with neuroscientists, mainly because when I started to read what they were finding, it matched my experience of meditation and matched my experience with my students in the benefits they were reporting. So I became curious and open to see whether more people could become interested in meditation and the benefits through this coming together with science to show that it's not just an altered state. It's not just part of a religious group that you have to be part of, but it really is, as I would like to present today, part of the human lineage. So from ancient times, wisdom traditions and these growth areas brought on by meditation, inquiry, and spiritual practice have been the most revered dimensions of human consciousness. Most of the wise gals and wise guys of the world have been involved with shifting their consciousness from a kind of basic consciousness to a higher consciousness, an expanded consciousness, a deeper consciousness, a wider consciousness. And so what we're going to do is talk a little bit about what that is today and what the markers are in terms of neuroscience or what we've discovered so far. You know, in terms of the dialogue, you know, I know recently I read that when the Dalai Lama was asked, what would you do if science disputed some of the claims in your meditation tradition? And he paused and said, why, I'd simply change my beliefs. So there's some kind of openness that's possible. And my interest is particularly not just in the initial stages of meditation, which is most of the research that has been done so far, but I'm interested in the potential of awakening, which means the potential of human consciousness to reach its fullness. And I believe that it's more accessible today with the help of modern science, particularly psychology and neuroscience. And I've been involved in kind of reverse engineering some of the meditation practices that I've learned from many of the wisdom traditions to help really particularly make a contemporary model and method to help us to shift from really from a kind of suffering on many levels to a relief of suffering and to reveal perhaps some of our innate qualities of well-being. So let's begin by talking a little about different aspects of neuroscience and then some meditation research, and I'll expand on the model of meditation research to talk about some of the research that's beginning to be done on more of what's called awakening. So let me begin by saying something about awakening in a very simple way, which is that awakening is kind of awakening from a small sense of self, almost as if there's a point of view in our minds that we're located not only in our bodies, but in our head behind our eyes looking out. And there's a self center that I'll talk about the different ways that it is felt to be that way in the different areas of the brain and the different complexes of systems that keep that in place and ways to open that up. So waking up from that small sense of self to a more higher, expanded, deeper, broader sense of pure awareness, or even beyond kind of a mindful witness, which is watching, but to a kind of open, spacious awareness. And then as that spacious awareness to wake in to our bodies so that we're transcendent and including our bodies. So there's a openness and a dropping from head to heart, a kind of moving from back of brain to midbrain to front brain, to opening from the executive function to our spacious awareness, but not remaining there as a transcendent witness or just a mindful, detached person, but then from that ground of awareness, feeling that there is this spacious and pervasive dimension of consciousness, which is called often unity consciousness or embodied awareness or simultaneous mind in many traditions. And then a sense of not only waking up into the awareness, but waking into your body, and then waking out to compassionate activity, creativity, and relationship. And that is discovering this dimension of what's called heart-mind or open-hearted awareness, which feels as if there is a kind of balance from front to back, from left to right, from outside to inside, from individual to interconnectedness with everyone, to relationality and relationship with other people. And that type of consciousness, I feel, is an innate potential that can be shifted into and then trained into fairly quickly. And there are some early scientific experiments which are pointing in that direction. And I'm seeing a lot of results in my own trainings with other people. And so let's talk a little bit more about the particulars of that. So this sense of studies in meditation. So there are two main areas that have been studied, and they've been given names and letters to signify their particular type of meditation. So the first kind of meditation that's been studied in mindfulness tradition is called focused attention, or FA. It's a one-pointed attention. It's the focus on your breath or a candle or a mantra or one object. And the idea is to train attention to focus, and then also to train yourself to, when you lose focus, to know you've lost focus. That's kind of the second skill. And then the third skill is to return to that focus and retrain attention. And that focused attention is called shamatha, peaceful abiding, calm abiding. It calms the small moving mind and allows the attentional areas of your brain to be more strong and available to and be less distracted. And then the second type of meditation that's been studied, it's called open monitoring. This comes, or OM, sometimes called insight meditation or mindfulness, the four foundations of mindfulness, mindfulness of thoughts, feelings, sensations, and consciousness itself. And this is almost an internal observing of contents of consciousness. This is a type of mindfulness where you actually make what I call the mindful move, which is stepping back from identification with thinking to first a kind of self-conscious self-awareness, which is a commentator, and then stepping back even one more degree or back this way to observe that the thoughts that are occurring to you are not always who you are or are not always true. So if the thought goes, I don't know if I can handle this anymore, from a mindful witness, from open monitoring, you see, oh, that's a thought. I don't think I can handle this anymore. It doesn't mean it's true, and it doesn't mean it's you. It just means that it is happening to you. There's a feeling, a thought, and then there's an observer or an observing place, witnessing, from which you can then not identify with automatic negative thoughts. So even if you hear a siren in the background, as I record from New York City, that could trigger a feeling of thought or memory of something in your body, and then you could step back or open up to notice the sensations or the feelings associated with that. And then the third category is what I'm going to spend some time on, which is a category called non-dual awareness, or NDA. And this is a type of awareness that has been added to the studies, although very few studies have been done. The interesting thing is, though I'm not a neuroscientist, I've been a subject in a bunch of neuroscience experiments. I've been in the fMRI and had my brain scanned while meditating. And one of the interesting studies I did at Yale with Judson Brewer was in a what's called a real time fMRI, where we were able to see a screen in front of us, above us, that had a green lines above the baseline and red lines below. And that when we were operating from a self-centered, self-conscious point of view, which was actually, this study was looking at PCC, the area of the brain that is related to self-referencing, that you could do one of the practices, either focused attention, open monitoring, or non-dual awareness, and discover that you could reduce the self-referencing thinking, which has tremendous benefits. Now, the other experiment I was in with Zoran Josipovic from NYU was a study on non-dual awareness, where he distinguished the difference between focused attention, open monitoring, and non-dual awareness. And the interesting thing is that in focused attention, you begin to affect the what's called the default mode network. And so the default mode network is an area of study that actually looks at your not only areas of your brain, but actually a system or a mode that we all naturally have. It was discovered by a scientist, Marcus Reichle, who just asked people just do nothing in an fMRI in between studies. And what he discovered is that the brain is active no matter what you're doing. And then studies were followed up on this to discover that there's two modes. One is a task positive mode, which is externally focused or extrinsic, and then a mode that goes internally focused and often goes to thinking or to daydream. And that's the default part of the default mode. So the task positive and the default mode of the default mode network. Another study was done at Harvard where they asked students to carry around a beeper and ask them simply, are you doing a task or not doing a task? If you're doing a task, are you happy or unhappy? Or if you're not doing a task, are you unhappy or happy? And they found that 50% of the time people were not doing a task, and that 80% of the time when they were not doing a task, they were unhappy. So the study concluded that a wandering mind is an unhappy mind. And so one of the most important things to discuss or to understand is this kind of default mode network. And to come back to the study with Zoran at NYU, what we know now is that focused attention is a task mode network dominant type of meditation. So what you're doing is you're calming self-referencing by repressing the internal network and just activating the external network. And then when you do open monitoring, you're not paying attention to or repressing the external network, and you're just watching or paying attention to the internal network. And that also gives you a feeling of not self-referencing. But here's the interesting thing, is that the non-dual awareness meditation balances both of them. So in other words, the both internal and external dimensions of the default mode network are both on at the same time. So you have this feeling of a continuous field, an ability almost to be aware of inside and aware of outside simultaneously. So there's this feeling of a continuous interconnected observing, and it really is the only way you can function in life with your eyes open is from a balanced. Otherwise, you have to be alternating outside, inside, which is what we do most of the time. So this non-dual awareness type of meditation, which I call effortless mindfulness or effortless mindfulness embodied, and then it moves to effortless heart mindfulness, is a way to train immediately into this type of awake consciousness that's similar to a flow state, which I'll come back to a little bit. So non-dual, by non-dual awareness, what I mean is something that often people don't think they know, but they do know without having a category in our Western philosophy or Western psychology. It's actually an awareness of a spacious awareness, and it's a shift out of thought-based knowing to awareness-based knowing, so that you're alert and aware, and you can be aware of contents of consciousness internally and what's happening externally, because you're actually aware of a kind of awareness that's already aware by itself without your help. So rather than focusing and concentration from the small mind, which is what attention is, non-dual awareness is not a form of attention. Attention is a form of awareness, and non-dual awareness, its first dimension is pure awareness or nature of mind from which you're aware. So it seems at first you're aware of the awareness that's quiet and still, silent, open, like a sky in which thoughts are like birds, moods are like clouds. But then you realize you're aware from and as that awareness. And then there's a feeling that that awareness is what's aware both from outside and from within. So there's a feeling of spacious and embodied awareness. And so some people define non-dual as just the pure awareness, but in the tradition I'm from, non-dual awareness means both formlessness and form, ultimate reality of pure awareness and relative reality of everyday reality. So the non-dual is not two. They're not two things, but the shift is to this foundation of awareness, which is really what most awakening definitions have in common is there's another dimension of consciousness that's not thought-based, that's not brain, that's not the constituents of the brain, but they include the constituents of the brain. So you could have, you could be fully aware while thoughts and emotions, fear is happening from this awareness and feel this kind of loving presence toward the part of you that's upset or worried, or without identifying with it and without spacing out or repressing or fighting or flighting, but just feeling fully human. And that's really what non-dual awareness makes possible. So let me talk a little about this balancing of back to front, left to right, top to bottom, inside to outside. So often if we just look at the structures of the brain, we know that many of the neuroscience discoveries are that there's a reptilian brain in the back, which is very much involved with security, safety. If we're in that part of the brain, we're looking, we're scared, we're scanning for danger, and we're dominated by almost an instinctual survival. So we want to move to the midbrain, which is more the relational, social, but still emotional, can be reactive mammalian brain. And then we often develop our prefrontal cortex, where we have the ability to analyze and develop executive function or a sense of rationality, but also we can be hyper aware from our this kind of center, and it creates a third problem rather than the fear or the sense of being overwhelmed or out of control. We actually create this sense of selfing, which gives us a feeling of making the executive function into as if we're the executive. And one of the interesting studies by Csikszentmihalyi, who studied a flow state, he discovered that there are seven qualities of a flow state, which a flow state is sometimes described with the term transient hypofrontality. So what that means is it's a changing state, but instead of being frontal lobe dominant, it's not hyperfrontal, it's hypo, meaning you go beyond. It's a temporary shifting out of the prefrontal cortex into a more whole body, whole brain, balanced type of awareness that many people know from doing activities that you love. Many of the things we do as our playtime or vacation time are to get into a kind of a flow state, or what's called being in the zone. People walk in nature. There's activities where you can get into a zone, sports, dance. And the seven qualities are that you know an activity is doable, that your skills, that you've learned the basic skills, you've kind of put in the knowing how to dance, the knowing how to do the sport, the knowing how to do the scientific work that you get into a flow about. Then number two is being able to be completely involved and focused on what you're doing. And then that brings a sense of bliss or ecstasy, is the third quality he mentions. And the fourth is a great inner clarity and knowing what needs to be done and how well you're doing it without going to the judging function. Then the fifth quality is there's a sense of serenity, no worries about oneself, a feeling of going beyond the boundaries of the ego. Number six is a timelessness, a being thoroughly focused in the now so that you feel like time has slowed down. If you're in a sports venue, you feel like you know where everyone is. You hear the crowd, you see everything that needs to be done, and you just trust. You have this amazing sense of trust. And the seventh is there's an intrinsic motivation. Whatever produces flow becomes its own reward. So there's a feeling of going beyond living from this ego-centered or ego identity or self-center or executive function. And this is kind of an important experience to realize that our map needs to be kind of upgraded as we progress along from one-pointed attention, focused attention, to open monitoring, to non-dual awareness or effortless mindfulness, heart mindfulness. We can balance front to back, left and right brain, internal and external from the default mode. And then we can really feel like we've almost dropped from head to heart, from head to body, to heart, to gut, to a feeling of a full body, up and down, inside and out. And that's the feeling you get almost naturally when you go beyond this sense of creating a small sense of self in your brain. Okay, so it's not just quieting the posterior cingulate cortex, the PCC, which is what happens in the most meditations, which stops the chattering mind, moves the automatic thoughts into the background, but it's really discovering a more holistic feeling of well-being that is a sense of self that's interconnected with all parts of your body, all things in the world, just interconnected flow, a sense of open-heartedness and intelligence that is coming from love and compassion rather than separation. So this sense of moving out of this little manager, what I call the mini me, which feels like it's in your head looking out, and it really is kind of the co-opting of your brain's survival programs. That sense of the negativity bias is co-opted, and it's almost as if there's a little thought-based entity in your mind that needs to survive. So it's not even about your body surviving, but almost the thinking creates a thinker that takes itself to be me, and then it continually tries to solve the problem of me based on using the body's boundary and survival program. So this little secondary self, this self which causes the suffering and doesn't have to be the center, when it relaxes, you can feel almost immediately that you go into or might be able to taste this sense of awakened open-heartedness. So the main job that it does is it's continually problem solving. So it's this problem solving part of you, but it's not the problems in the world. You have stuff to deal with in your regular life, that's fine, and you will deal with them better when you shift. But it's this problem solving little mini me, this that feels it's an entity that needs to get satisfaction, but because it's not an entity, there's nothing for it to be satisfied with, and it always feels threatened, but nothing can hurt it because it's not a real sense of self. So let's do, we're gonna do a couple of trainings here, practice, because it's the neuroscience training summit. So let's do a very short inquiry around this problem solver center, this executive function, ego identity, self center. So to say two things about that is that, as neuroscientists have said, there's no center of self that can be found in the brain. There's no location of a self. There's a thought-based self-referencing that seems to be related to the PCC and the default mode. But even then, you can still have a feeling of a separate self even then. So it's this one extra move to find the awareness-based, embodied, interconnected sense of self, which feels, as many people will say, as if they've come home, right? So you may have heard that quote, that the brain is like an orchestra, but no conductor can be found. So let's see what it's like if you just take a minute while you're listening here, and then we'll do the simple inquiry, and then you can either type afterwards or report before the question and answer some of what you find so that other people can hear you as well. So it's a very simple way, whether you're watching or whether you're just listening to this. Just simply, instead of listening to me or looking at me, I want you just to kind of let me point you within. Instead of a PowerPoint, I'll point you toward yourself. So let your awareness look back instead of out, feel back, and just inquire with your awareness when you ask yourself this question. What's here now when there's no problem to solve? So just understand the question with your mind, and then drop your awareness and open it, look back and feel. Don't look up to thought and don't go down to sleep. So again, just simply, what's here? Who's here? What's aware? Just now, when there's no problem to solve, when you're not the problem solver. So just feel into the awareness that's aware without your help, without looking from the executive function or the ego center, but feeling from your wholeness. Notice the qualities of dimensionality. Feel what's absent, that was here, and then feel the qualities of presence that begin to show up. Just rest in that and notice that you can discover a kind of quietness. But the importance is that you go beyond ego center and that you discover the new operating system of awareness, embodied, open-hearted. So you could not just get caught in the gap of being spaced out or being no self, but you step out of the non-ego into the awareness that's the ground of your being and feel that awareness that's also embodied and arising as the ocean of awareness arising, as your aliveness of your particular human being and your interconnectedness, and feel that sense of balance, front to back, top to bottom, left to right, inside and outside, simultaneously aware without efforting. So this is kind of an effortless heart mindfulness. And just notice what that's like as a possibility. So it's important that we see that awakening could be the next stage of human development, that there, it isn't just about calming or using our attention to be more highly functioning egos, that there is this additional stage beyond a ego and beyond a meditator even, and beyond a calm self-center, that is a kind of innate potential, right? So when we go through this kind of series, and you can, if you want to type some answers now, you can, or you can, when we have question and answer, you can do that. But we have this, you know, shift when we do meditation or inquiry, we change our state. And then when we do it often enough, we change our trait. So the brain changes and it becomes the new normal. But then I think there's a third category called innate, the innate potential. So we have state changes, trait changes, which are very important to the brain and your body as the new normal. And then we change to this innate potential of awakening, which is basically a shift in the way of knowing. So we're not thought-based thinker or ego center, but we're an awareness-based, embodied, interconnected sense of being or bigger self with a, and then thought becomes a function that we can use, and attention becomes a tool, which is appearing to a new center of identity. So it's a shift of knowing and a shift of the center of identity from a head to spaciousness, to embodied, to open-hearted and interconnected feeling of being, which you can see on in when we do the exercises and then in the monitoring of the fMRIs. So the other area that you notice this feeling of spaciousness or expandedness or boundlessness. We'll do another exercise in a minute that's more expanded, and then we'll have some question and answers, or answers and questions, or comments and responses. That one of the studies and the people I did a talk with was Andrew Newberg, who studied the superior parietal lobes, which are on the sides of your brain. And they are set in the midbrain with a sense of giving you a sense of separation of self physically. And they're on very actively. When you do this kind of meditation, they come down from a very active to a moderate level, and you still have a very, you know, strong sense of your physical boundary of your body, and you're in a, as you do, in a flow state, but you have this feeling of more spaciousness and more interconnectedness because the superior parietal lobes, which he called the orientation association area, are not dominating. So when you do this awareness training, that part of the brain relaxes into what I think is a normal level, a new normal level of innate functioning that isn't hypervigilant. The amygdala will calm down. The parts of the brain associated with your compassion area begin to activate. A sense of low-level bliss will happen because, as Patricia Sharp did an experiment with people relating to addiction, she realizes there's almost an addiction of the self center to thought, and it's always looking. And when she had people do this, did this awareness of awareness-based embodied practice, she noticed that the addictive tendency of the brain relaxed and more endorphins and a sense of almost a natural feeling, almost like you do after you exercise, is the natural feeling of your body when you're not in this hypervigilant state. So let's do one more neuroscience training for the summit here before we go to the next section of interaction with you at home. So I'm going to do. So first one, exercise one was a very simplest one. What's here now if there's no problem to solve? And this has a bunch of parts. So the suggestion is, you know, don't worry about the instructions. Don't try to do it. I'm actually not talking to you, the ego center, or even to attention. I'm actually talking to you, the already awake awareness that may be able to do this time and give it a try. With beginner's mind and open heart, see what happens. Yeah. So we're going to use return your eyes to their natural state and then open awareness around into kind of a panoramic awareness and then feel this embodied balance field that I was talking about. So this is kind of a multidimensional brain mind awareness training. So the first thing to say is that your brain is about 40% of it is focused on thinking or involves your thinking, and then also 40% is involved with seeing your so that we're very much involved with scanning for danger, right? And we know that hearing is receiving, but it almost as if you look at something in the room and now look at something else in the room and now look at something else, it's almost as if, doesn't it feel almost like you're using sight like your hand? Like, give me that. Let me see that. Look at that. Look at that. But if you realize that sound we experience very naturally, that sound comes, we feel from outside, to our eardrums, to our perception. Seeing is the same way. Light reflects off of objects and comes to us. So hearing is receiving and seeing is receiving. So just feel what that's like on a biological basis. You're safe if seeing is receiving because light is traveling at the speed of light. So you don't have to go grab anything. So this will unhook your grasping mind and let you relax into this awareness-based, holistic, whole body way of knowing, whole brain, body, mind, if you let awareness, light reflect off of objects, come to your eyes, your retina, to perception, and then go right to this awareness-based knowing. And now notice also the space between you and an object. So be aware of space between you and an object, be aware of space between your eyes, be aware of space between your ears, and then let your awareness rest back behind you to the space behind you until you notice perhaps that there's already a spacious awareness that's aware behind you, that feels into you, and is just naturally aware of seeing without effort. And now just notice that there is this ability to take a breath and then breathe out a little longer than you breathe in and feel your body as you receive light. Feel from this awareness. And notice that just by breathing in, your autonomic nervous system comes into balance. And then look at the space in front of you or a little above the screen and smile. And as you do that, notice the endorphins that are released. Because as soon as your eyes look up, you're telling your brain that's involved with safety, that there's nothing to worry about on the ground level. And your brain will, by looking up, breathing and smiling, you'll feel this sense of natural bliss and ease. And now just begin to move your awareness around in, to what feels like opening your peripheral vision. Your peripheral vision is actually already open, and peripheral vision doesn't mean that you're moving your eyes. So feel like your eyes are soft and relaxed, but simply looking either straight ahead or a little up. Just begin to gently open your peripheral vision by moving awareness to the sides. Breathe and smile. And as awareness goes to the side, just notice that your view is opening. And just enjoy that gentle, open view so you can see everything in front of you, not just one particular thing. And then as awareness gets to the side, let it unhook from seeing and let awareness be aware of the space at the side of your body in which sound is coming and going. And let awareness continue around to feel and know the space behind you. So feel as if you've opened your peripheral vision, unhooked awareness to the sides in which sound is coming and going, and you've opened your view, 180-degree peripheral, 360-degree panoramic awareness. And just notice that feeling of being aware of space all around. And breathe in. And then just be curious, am I aware of the spacious awareness? Or what is it like when I'm aware from the spacious awareness back to thoughts, feelings, and sensations? So just feel that like flip turn. Just what's it like to be aware of the open, spacious awareness? And what's it like to be aware from the open, spacious awareness? What's it like when spacious awareness is aware and is actually an ocean of awareness that's arising as this aliveness of your body? So feel this continuous field of spacious and pervasive awareness that's alive and has dropped from head to heart and is more aware from outside and inside equally, so that you're alert without going up to thought to know, without going down to sleep, without going back to daydream. Just here, feeling the aliveness inside and awareness of whatever's outside equally, because you're aware of the awareness that's aware without your help and is arising as interconnected, open-hearted presence. So just feel what that's like to have dropped into this heart space, this open-heartedness that's both outside and inside. So you're not spaced out, you're not blissed in. Just notice this feeling of balance front to back, left to right, inside to outside, top and bottom. So you're not looking from this point of view, you're feeling from this feeling of holistic well-being, and you have a new ground so that in some ways it's just ordinary you. Yeah, just feel you, yeah, I'm here. But there's not a commentator. Notice what's absent. Notice what open-hearted awareness knows to be true. Notice how your brain feels, your body feels, your identity, the spatial quality, the connection to things outside and inside, and the sense of well-being or presence, stillness, silence. And yet, from here, you could bring talking, thinking, typing, relating to others, creativity online without losing this. So that becomes the key training. And then from here, you can also begin from this open-hearted awareness, begin to include different things from your psychological history or any upset or any difficult situation without losing this. So you mix, you begin to mix this presence and open-heartedness with situations, old traumas, and you resource yourself with the source itself, the source of this innate quality of your being or true self. So you begin to feel that there's a part of you that's upset, but it's appearing to you, this spacious, embodied, open-hearted well-being. And that's where you begin from here almost to do the psychological healing work and the offloading of liberating of contents of consciousness or difficult situations that seem too big to deal with, because now you have a fully embodied, balanced, whole brain, whole body, neurochemically alive, and that systems are both individuated and then they're brought together in a new way that is holistic and awakened from the old system. So it's really a shift, not just of calming the first system and making that brain that's currently operating and it's the calmest and highest functioning, but the next stage of awakening is awakening from the way of knowing and the center of identity to this new operating system, which then has the ability and to return your body to a natural feeling of safety, well-being, responsiveness. So you feel like a Tai Chi master. You could respond to any situation in life and you're in the flow. So you can, all the functions that you have input through training, through study, through walking and talking, you've done 10,000 hours of walking, talking, thinking, relating. So you can shift right into this new operating system and live from kind of an awakened, open-hearted flow. And that will help your neuroscience, will help your mind, your brain, your relationships, and bring a sense of compassion, because that's the last quality that comes, is a sense of joy, happiness for no reason. So it's beyond happiness biologically. It's beyond happiness of positive thinking. It's, you discover a joy and safety, a sense of well-being that your body innocently responds to and feels like you've untied knots and returned it to its natural condition. And your body will feel very happy that you found this happiness that isn't dependent on conditions or external or internal, so that when daily ups and downs happen, you feel very, very much able to respond. So I'll just finish with this last little experiment that was done by Richard Davidson that can give you a sense of what this is like. So Richard Davidson, University of Wisconsin, and his colleagues did a study of Tibetan monks who had done this kind of effortless mindfulness-based practice, which is the one I teach and I'm teaching you. And then some college students, and they were given a very negative auditory stimulation, like a screaming young baby who was in pain in their ears. And then they measured the emotion, both before, during, and after. And then they told them, now we're going to keep repeating this every few minutes. And what they discovered is that as it went on, the college students started to have anticipatory anxiety way before the auditory negative stimulation happened. Then they spiked, and then they had longer self-referential memory reflective negativity long after, minutes and minutes after that. Whereas those monks who had done this kind of practice and were in this as an innate condition, not even a trait, but this is where they live. This is what their, not only their state or their trait, but actually their new normal operating system. They would have almost no anticipatory anxiety. Then they would have this emotion, and then they would recover almost immediately. Now, the interesting thing is they usually had more emotional feeling than the average college student. So I just wanted to finish on that, because even when they did compassion training, that it's not about spacing out or denying your emotions, but feeling and being fully human without having this being dominated by the negativity bias or by these associative patterns from the past and projecting them into the future and having self-referencing anxiety. So so I hope you enjoyed this short sharing from my experience, and I look forward to meeting some of you in the future. I have a effortless mindfulness research projects where I'm looking to share these practices and continue this kind of studies, you know, for the benefit of all beings. So thank you very much.
Luck, thank you very much. Those practices were really impactful. And I want to just start with a question that came up for me as you were talking about those students who were engaged in practicing, how it allowed them to feel their feelings. I was wondering, you know, how this practice as a default or an operating system, like how it works in community, because right here I'm in the studio by myself doing these practices with you, and I can feel this sense of expansion and awareness of so much around me. And I wonder, moving that out into the world, does that mean that I'm making space for more people around me and for their emotions? And is it cultivating a sense of compassion and empathy? And, you know, I'm just wondering how merging into that greater sense of community, what do we do with that?
Yeah, it's great. What a great question, because you're leading where I was ending, because, you know, I kind of was giving people some of the background and then some individual experience. But then, as you say, it begins to be about being fully human, and fully human is certainly interpersonal. And these kind of practices are not just that are not just done by retreating and going away and doing state changes, but the main practice of this particular type of meditation that I've been studying and learning and teaching is done with small glimpses many times during the day. And so it's meant to do with your eyes open, and it's meant to change your innate sense of identity and relationality and feeling of creativity and interconnectedness, so that you aren't really separating meditation from secular time, that you literally are awakened and relating to people living this, which is the big difference, is that you can live in the middle of, you know, any place, New York City, from an awake, interconnected dimension, and just be yourself with other people wherever they are in a compassionate mode. You're not trying to change them, but you are bringing and relating and connecting to them in a way that they tend to pick up on.
Mm-hmm. I already am calling to mind various responses that I've heard over the course of, you know, taking questions from different viewers about feeling sensitive to other people's emotions and how can they protect or shut down or kind of.
Yes.
You know.
So this So let me answer that, because I think this is, it's almost, okay, so let's just say there's two types of modes that people in meditation tend to come from and almost tend to emphasize. So sometimes one mode is like too detached, a detached meditative observer. So you create this very detached, non-emotional meditative observer. I'm aware of my feelings. I have no attachment. I see my thoughts and my emotions, and I'm free of them, right? And that's kind of an extreme on one side. And the other side, which a lot of people, you develop a kind of openness and of interconnectivity that is relating from your emotional body. So many people have this type of empathetic development, which is different than compassion, and certainly different than this kind of ultimate compassion, which this practice teaches. But that empathetic resonance takes on the energy of people and is so overwhelmed by it because we're still operating from a mental, emotional body, ego, trying our best to be spiritual and be kind and not hurt, but taking everything on. So this practice is designed exactly for those people. You step out of your mental and emotional body into this awareness. When the awareness comes back as the ground, you feel everything, just as the study of the monk. You still feel it, but it doesn't stick. It doesn't stay in your system. So just like that practice with that monk, there's no anticipation. You'll feel somebody, and then you'll be able to return to your own baseline, and you won't take on or have to resonate or take on the hot potato that somebody else handles you. You'll feel like it, you'll feel it, but then it goes right through you to the support of awareness that has your back.
And so it's more of a breathing kind of sense rather than overly porous and overly saturated. So shall we go right into responses from the practices? Okay, so from practice one, we have a comment from Pilar. I felt no thing, very different from my normal practice, vast, limitless.
Yes, so there's that feeling of shifting out of that first operating system. So with all the positive preliminary practices, and neuroscience, helpful breathing, energy, you know, using visualization, you will still feel bound and limited to your body, brain, and with a sense of an identity and executive function in your frontal lobe. So almost the first shift into the new operating system is to shift out of the thingness and the felt sense of separation and into the no thing and into the vast spaciousness or emptiness, but then to immediately see if anybody had the experience of shifting not only out of, but into the awareness, which was then embodied, open-hearted, and interconnected.
Well, Lucas writes, in the first practice, I felt more aware of a vast, loving space around me, and my ego or small self kind of dissolved into it, although I was still aware of my physical dimension. Is this normal?
This is the deal. This is what's called a glimpse, which is, you know, is a more than a state experience. It's a short experience often. But it's a glimpse of the innate, natural, new operating system of open-hearted awareness or awakened heart or awake nature. This is how you can walk around feeling this loving presence and normal, alert wakefulness. And this is a taste that, and it shows that how close it is to all of us, that it is an innate condition that people can experience it having. Some who have had no background of this, which is the amazing thing. And the reported results and the reported brain changes markers in when in the fMRI are very clear how positive they are.
And that was a question that actually came up for me too during the presentation was, I wonder what your findings show from your work with neuroscientists about the effect on our body and brains over time. Can you say a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I mean, that's, I think that's, you know, that's why I gave that last example of this, somebody who has clearly trained in this particular similar tradition of that monk doing the experiment with the negative auditory experience, that there is non-reactivity and yet emotional sensitivity. So the long-term natural condition is that, you know, people like that can walk into an fMRI and their default network is already balanced. In other words, because that's the way you start to walk around, that I believe it's the next natural stage of human development to shift into this awakened consciousness, not just to calm our current ego, to have a little calmer, high functioning ego. Because when I've seen people in therapy who have, you know, been very successful in family life and success in work, and they come at some point with some kind of, is that all there is? Because they haven't woken up out of this small ego identified self-center, and it will create perpetual anxiety and dissatisfaction on some level.
I think this comment from Louise kind of speaks to that. She writes, in practice one, I got extremely emotional when I reflected on that question. I feel extreme discomfort in my body when I sit and do nothing, as if I need to earn my space in the world. To sit and not fidget requires me to breathe deeply and consciously relax my muscles. And after the calm, I felt warm and thought of all the things I love doing that help me to experience flow.
Yes. Yeah, so you can see that this kind of practice, that first one was an effortless mindfulness practice. So a lot of people, because I taught mindfulness in kind of what I call deliberate mindfulness or basic mindfulness. And a lot of people have very hard time concentrating because they're efforting, they're trying to get one pointed focus. They're developing some basic skills that are very helpful, but this kind of dropping into this awareness that's already aware, it's already calm and loving and embracing and able to focus effortlessly, so you don't have to effort. You just kind of get on board and get in the river and just, you know, flow down into your life and respond rather than react.
That feels really nourishing just hearing you say that. It kind of helps to deliver me right into that. Yeah. That was, can you just come around with me everywhere I go?
Well, this is the thing. I mean, this particular way I teach is like, give the tools, don't be the guru. You know, in other words, I've designed this set of experiments, which I share a little here, and they're in my book, Shift into Freedom. You can learn them, and I've had people write me emails from around the world. I've been doing this for 3 months. I've got it now. I'm able to do it any time of the day.
And exactly, that's what you said earlier in the presentation. Don't look at me. I'm pointing you back to your own, to your own spaciousness and oneness. So let's move to practice two. This comes from Judith. Going in, I felt and heard silence around me and felt all of my body warm and full. Open, receiving, and giving at the same time. Very content with no limits, surprisingly calm. Could this being and awareness be attributed to this exercise, or because today I was not rushed and relatively calm? Thank you so much for your sharing, Locke, she says.
You're very welcome, Judith. Yeah. I mean, it's you, so it could happen anywhere. You could have, see, once you get a feeling for it and know it and have it as a category, you could just be walking down the street and look up at a tree and go like, oh, and just shift right into it. But this exercise is, you know, as I said, I kind of reverse engineered what are the pointers that don't get into efforting that actually use awareness to shift the mind, to shift the brain, so that you can intentionally access something that's natural and effortless. And that's, you know, what she reported, Judith, what you reported is the result of kind of untying knots of our own way of perceiving and orienting our identity and knowing and neurobiology. And once you untie those knots, there's the innate peace of mind, loving presence, high functioning, focused flow state.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of flow, yep. Doug says it's like swimming in the ocean, being aware that there's water all around you.
Yeah. Wow. Beautiful. It's like, see, people like they become Lao Tzu, you know, they're like, they're poets. You know, that's, I can't add anything to that. What am I going to say?
One more. This one comes from Silas. After doing the second practice, I suddenly felt that I was okay, even though I'm going through a difficult time right now. I felt a sense of relief and like I'm in a place to deal with what's happening in my life.
Yes. Wow. So beautiful. That is like, you know, even if I never say the words of what you'll experience, that sense of okayness, that I'm okay. It goes below the negativity bias. It goes below the feeling of anxiety. It goes below the feeling of shame. It goes into the sense of okayness, well-being, innocence. And that is really what it's all about. From there, and interestingly, as he said, that and yet I'm dealing with this from the okayness, I can deal with this difficult situation I'm going through. So it's not an escape from, it's an accessing of a dimension of identity and knowing and well-being from which I can respond to and show up for life, to continue to show up and grow up and live from a completely different awakened consciousness, though. It's absolutely, yeah, these glimpses are amazing, right? Because it's, some of them it's the first time, and it's just our innate possibility.
And Locke, in these glimpses and lack of efforting, I noticed that when you mention the negativity bias and anxiety, you're not talking about how we might address them or reduce them or eliminate them at all. It's just, is it just stepping into this awareness and into these glimpses that gives us that ability to be with them and let them?
Yes. Mm-hmm. That's absolutely, certainly the beginning is always that way. It does change them as a trait. Like let's say the negativity bias is almost like our DNA. So if you have, you know, well, let's go even one more. It could help, like if you have, you know, a physiological condition, it won't necessarily change that, but you'll be able to be with it easier. So your negativity bias is a kind of a part of the ancient functioning of your brain, and you'll be able to be with that part of you, realizing it's part of you, it's not who you are, and you'll even feel it operating. Oh my God, what's going to happen? Sometimes you'll just be able to kind of relate to it and not identify with it and have a loving presence for it, and it'll just continue. And then sometimes it'll kind of get on board and go like, okay, I guess nothing's really that, you know, that much to be worried about. And then it'll also change in certainly in terms of its predominance. It'll be less, it'll fire off less, it'll be less primary, it'll get healed. The old brain will get changed through, you know, over time. But initially, it's about being with different parts of yourself, brain, whether brain or personality, and not changing them, but finding this awareness that naturally loves them and is able to be okay while they're not okay.
Mm-hmm. And I just want to back up for some of our viewers who might not be familiar with the term negativity bias. Can you say a little bit about what that is?
Yes. So, I mean, there's, you know, there's a, you know, there's some good programs early on. Rick Hansen talks about the negativity bias and a number of other neuroscientists, that our brain from early on in developmental biology has developed a part of our brain where in order to survive over time, our species has to have emphasized looking for potential danger at any time. Certainly it started with physical, physiological, being in the jungle or the desert or the Stone Age times. And if you didn't anticipate and learn from situations and plan for potential danger, you didn't survive. So he talks about, you know, you have a carrot and a stick, and that you can not have a carrot all the time. If you miss a carrot for a day, you'll be okay. But if you miss the stick, if you miss the predator who lives in a certain part of the, you know, the territory, and you forget as you walk by, you won't survive. So the brain looks to the potential, looks to the past, finds a negative situation, looks to scan in the present, is it around, and then projects worst case scenarios to try to be safe physically. And then that brain pattern continues both socially and internally about any situation. And I believe it actually gets co-opted by this mini me, by this little thought-based identity that then, I think that's what the daydreaming default mode when people are unhappy is, it's that negativity bias that the little false sense of self or the imagined sense of self is trying to protect itself. And when we did that first exercise, you could see that when you just step out of that problem solver, the negativity bias of that dimension of consciousness is gone. And then if you really look at the situation in the room, there's no tiger. So you start to realize with a little reality testing that you don't need, you know, you don't need to be hypervigilant all the time. And you develop this other dimension of this new operating system of awake consciousness, which operates like a Tai Chi master, in that you can plan ahead, you can respond, you without being reactive or hypervigilant.
This question comes in a few parts from Peter, who writes, I have a regular meditation practice where I focus on the breath and or the lower energy center in my belly. Could you say something about how this practice of regularly glimpsing and abiding relates to a more formal structured meditation? How might it complement, substitute, or maybe replace my regular practice? The fact is, I enjoy and feel more unhooked with the glimpses, but I'm afraid of letting go of the other breath practice. What might I be getting there that I might not be getting with the glimpses?
Yes. So, the general answer that I give to that kind of question is, if you like it, keep doing it. You know, so no need to give anything up. Keep going to the gym, keep doing your meditation, eat right. You know, everything that's good, anything that you like is good. In some ways, this can be a compliment to that. So that's kind of a formal sitting practice. It brings benefits, no doubt. No doubt it brings benefits. It's been measurable. If he's feeling it, if you're feeling it, it's great. This is maybe a compliment or a next stage or just an adjunct that you can learn to do during the day. So if you have your formal practice in the morning or at night, these glimpse practices you can do as you're taking a break during the day with your eyes open, you look out the window at work, and you can do it in 3 minutes instead of a coffee break or a cigarette break. You can do a glimpse break, and then you start to do it small glimpses many times during the day. And when you glimpse during the day, then you go right. One of the most important things is you go right from there into activity, into community, into typing, into talking to your colleague or your boss or your, somebody around you. And then you see how it sustains and how you can talk from here. And then at some point you lose it. And then you start to be aware of, oh, what happened there? What was the trigger that I lost it? That's interesting. Oh yeah, I see that. It's because of the emotional situation or this happened or I got too involved in the content. And then you wait a little bit and then you do it again. You glimpse again, return, and then you engage. And what happens is you start to rewire your brain. You start to train your brain to live in the midst of daily life from awake consciousness by mixing the glimpsing with the daily interaction and creativity and relationships. So it becomes like it actually ends up making the awakeness stronger by not doing it always as a separate activity apart from community in the world and activity.
So Locke, we have time for one more question, and I want to combine a couple of questions from our viewers. And just talking about the glimpses, we're going into that state of awareness consciously, and yet with the experience of flow and even grace, to kind of borrow from traditional religious practices, grace and flow seem to be something that descend on us. I'm wondering how the two are related, because in a state of flow, maybe I can be writing or singing or washing the dishes or something, and there's a feeling of flow that happens in this repetitive movement, right? Whereas grace, something also happens, or feels in my own experience, it feels like grace descends on me and I have this expanded awareness that is also much like what I'm going into consciously in the exercises that you share with us. Can you talk about how those states are related, if at all?
Yes. So, yeah, I mean, I would say that, it would have to be, first of all, would be, what's the definition of grace? So my definition of grace is that grace isn't something that comes and goes from some bigger figure that sometimes will give it to you and sometimes won't. That my definition is that grace is always here. That grace is the dimension of reality, that when you drop out of the the resistance to it, it's naturally here. So it seems like it comes and goes, like when you're all of a sudden somewhere and you feel what you felt in the glimpse, it feels like, oh my God, I guess grace just came. It is grace, but are you sure that it wasn't here and now it's here? Are you sure that you weren't in a kind of consciousness that wasn't perceiving it, and now you're out of that consciousness, and then grace is here? Because that's my sense of when I've asked people and really, you know, detailed reporting, asked them to do it. Also, flow state, people often haven't taken it apart, but you intuitively kind of know how to get into it, whether it's washing dishes or athletes I've talked to or worked with who get into a flow state. They'll say, well, I do this to warm up and I do that. And if I do that, most of the time it works. So if you reverse engineer how you got into a flow state, the fact that you can get into it means you did something to get into it. So that's kind of how I developed these glimpse practices, is that there's a way to either untie the knots that are in the way, or more importantly, to have the awareness that can know itself, be the one that's the active mover. So rather than having your ego doer try to find spacious awareness, once you get a feel for it, you realize that, oh, the awareness is unhooking from thinking. You can even try it now just for a second, that awareness is unhooking from thought and dropping down to know your jaw from within your jaw, and awareness is dropping to know your throat from within your throat. And awareness that can know directly is dropping below your neck and knowing your upper body or your heart space directly from within your heart space. So you didn't do that. The awareness unhooked from the doer, and your awake consciousness has the ability to move and to do and to know and respond. Once you get a feel for it, you can enter a flow state. Awareness can enter a flow state, because awareness can move and do and know, because it's already the innate knowing dimension. And we're actually operating from a, you know, like a mistaken identity of a doer. And we're operating from a thought-based knowing that we think is the only knowing. So if awareness, once you're in the awareness, you can start to feel, okay, what's it like to be identified with a doer? Oh, I see. That's what it's like. Now unhook and drop and open. And now be aware of that awareness. Huh. And then, am I aware of the awareness, or is the awareness aware? Oh, the awareness is aware. Oh, so that's who I am, has been revealed. So that's kind of the project I've been doing, is kind of trying to find out how to intentionally access a flow state, and an awake return to awake consciousness. And it seems to be possible.
Very much so. You know, I've seen you speak a few times, and, you know, just as you say, once you get it, doing yeah. it, experiencing it yeah. is everything. Exactly. That's right. Exactly as you said, and the mistaken yeah. identity, unhooking and yeah. untying the knots.
Yes.
Excellent takeaways. Thank you so very much, Locke.
Thank you, Christy. Thank you, everyone. Hope to see you. Be well.
Yes, you as well. This concludes the 13th live session of our Neuroscience Training Summit. Once again, deep gratitude for Locke Kelly and this outstanding presentation. Please note, the recording of this session will remain accessible for free for 24 hours. And if you wish, you can also purchase the entire series with unlimited access to each recording, transcripts from each session, along with bonus gifts from our presenters. I'd also like to extend our gratitude to everyone who joined us today. We certainly enjoyed your participation, the questions and feedback that you submitted as well. Please join us for our next live session with Linda Graham. That'll take place later today at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. For Sounds True, I'm Christy Peoples, and I'd like to thank you so very much for joining us. SoundsTrue.com, many voices. One journey.